Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Vicky Lee, and today joined by my co-host, Julia Bradley. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public affairs discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at Beyond Headlines. That's BYOND_headlines. Enjoy the show. The Israel-Hamas war has taken an immense toll on both sides and caused thousands of casualties. As difficult of a topic as this is, shedding light on this war with an objective and critical lens is a vital endeavor in the hope that history should never repeat itself in this way again. Today, we take a step back to discuss the histories in the region and the rise of Hamas to power through to the present day. For our guest today, we welcome Mr. John Allen and Professor Alejandro Paz to help us get a better understanding about the backdrop of the Israel-Hamas conflict and how insurrection groups like Hamas rose into power in the region. Before we begin this episode, our hearts here at Beyond the Headlines go out towards those who have suffered and lost tremendously through the war, from both sides. Any statements we make in this episode are rooted in empathy and a desire for peace. Our focus is on fostering understanding, compassion, and support for those affected by the devastating consequences of war. We understand this is a difficult topic, so we welcome conversations on Twitter/X at Beyond Headlines, that's at BYOND_headlines, or by reaching out to us on Instagram at Beyond the Headlines. We're always listening.
Our first guest is John Allen. Mr. Allen is a former Canadian diplomat. He held the positions of minister at the Canadian Embassy in Washington from 2004 to 2006, and Assistant Deputy Minister of the Americas from 2010 to 2012. From 2006 to 2010, he was Canada's ambassador to Israel. John is currently a senior fellow at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto, a distinguished fellow of the Canadian International Council, and the chair of Rosanna Canada, a non-for-profit whose objective is to build bridges between Palestinians and Israelis via the health sector. So, first of all, welcome, John.
Thanks so much, Julia. I appreciate the welcome and being here.
I say we get right into it.
All right.
In the current conflict, what role do you think surrounding resistance groups have had on influencing Hamas and escalating tension within the region?
Well, it's a hard question because I don't know what's in the minds of Hamas leaders. Clearly, Hamas is more like ISIS and Al-Qaeda in the sense that they are more purely ideological and radical than, say, Hezbollah. They are willing to sacrifice thousands of their fellow Palestinians for their cause. They're willing to die as martyrs. Hezbollah is far more political and is concerned about a repeat of the 2006 war with Israel, for example, which resulted in the bombing of South Beirut and a loss of credibility for Hezbollah among the Lebanese population. Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, said after the 2006 war that had he known beforehand what Israel's response would be, he wouldn't have engaged Israel. On the other hand, Hamas recently told the New York Times, and this was after October 7 and after Israel had begun its ground invasion, that Hamas would repeat October 7 again and again until their aim of ridding the Middle East of Israel and Jews was achieved. So, you know, there may be an influence in terms of training. There may be an influence in terms of political goals. But there are clear differences, I think, between, for example, Hezbollah and Hamas.
Understood. And on that note, I wanted to ask you,
what is Hezbollah's present place in the Middle East, and how does it influence the political landscape there?
Well, as I said, Hezbollah is both a political and a military force. It is very much a part of Lebanon's so-called confessional system, which divides the country politically into certain religious communities, and Hezbollah represents one. But at the same time, it has a military wing, and Hezbollah, which is Shia, is aligned with and substantially supported by Iran, from which it receives weapons, training, and money. Indeed, Hezbollah notionally acts as a kind of deterrent in respect of Israel's relations with Iran. It stands in between Iran and Israel and is there to kind of provide an ongoing potential threat against Israel. In fact, there is a saying in parts of the Middle East that Iran is prepared to fight Israel to the death of the last Arab. In other words, they don't want to get directly involved, but they're more than happy to see their allies, Hezbollah and Hamas, get involved and perhaps lose their soldiers, their militants. Hezbollah was established in the wake of the 1982 Lebanon War and has the largest and most powerful militia in the region. Its numbers and power exceed the militaries of Lebanon itself, of Syria and Jordan. It's reputed to have 100,000 fighters and between 130 and 150,000 missiles whose range can cover the entire country of Israel. In the current conflict, much to Hamas's disappointment, it seems, at least for now, that Hezbollah has decided to remain largely on the sidelines. It lobs daily rockets into Israel, resulting in the evacuation of thousands of Israelis living near the border, the Lebanese border, and it's forced Israel to send approximately half of its 350,000 person reserve soldiers to the north, not just to the south, for the Gaza war. But at least up until now, Hezbollah has stayed out of the full fray and just seems content to keep Israel off guard.
That is a very insightful look into these kinds of exchanges that you would see between Israeli people and these insurrectionist group in the Middle East. Thank you for that. And actually, on that note, you did mention that there is an emphasis on cleansing of Jewish people, of Israelis on the part of these groups. So I wanted to ask you, how are the agendas of these insurrection groups advanced through the exploitation of ethnic and sectarian divisions?
Again, I'm no expert on insurgent groups writ large, but I think I can say that most are intent on removing either Western interlopers or religious interlopers from the areas in which they operate. Hezbollah started with a charter, for example, that sought to eliminate the French and the U.S. from Lebanon, and then moved on to confronting Israel, both Western in Hezbollah's eyes and Jewish, obviously non-Muslim. Clearly, following the U.S.'s disastrous invasion of Iraq and its aftermath and in Afghanistan, ISIS and Al-Qaeda were able to gain strength and support from indigenous populations that viewed the U.S. and its various allies as enemies, either initially or after their failed interventions. So you can see a kind of pattern, which is essentially a combination of religion and anti-colonial, anti-imperial, anti-Western.
Despite the efforts done on the part of these insurrection groups to bring about dissent in the Middle East, we do notice that there are some efforts being done to renew relationships between the Arab world and Israel. So I wanted to ask you, how was the normalization of relations between Israel and some Arab states, as seen in the Abraham Accords, for example, affected the overall political dynamics in the region?
Well, both the Abraham Accords and the now off-the-table agreement that was being negotiated between Israel and the U.S. and Saudi Arabia were considered major gains for Israel, and to some extent, clearly gains for the countries involved. In the case of Morocco, Donald Trump's government agreed to their claims over the Western Sahara. As regards Sudan, they were taken off the terrorist list. And Bahrain and UAE were in line to be receiving significant, intelligence, information, and technology from Israel. Obviously, items that would not threaten Israel if things were to go wrong, but certainly things that they would see as helpful either vis-a-vis Iran or vis-a-vis their own populations. And as regards the Israel-Saudi U.S. deal, the Saudis were looking for a civilian nuclear information, intelligence, and the go-ahead to be able to further develop it. They were looking for arms from the U.S. Of course, in both cases, Israel was looking for recognition. Now, when you factor in the Palestinian question, that's where the problem arises, because you will recall that initially, and I'm talking in 2002, the Saudis had put forth a peace initiative, labeled the Saudi Peace Initiative or the Middle East Peace Initiative, which provided that if Israel recognized the Palestinians and delivered on a state for them, then all of the Arab states in the region would recognize Israel. Well, the Abraham Accords deviated from that, and you had four countries recognize Israel, and the Palestinians got essentially nothing out of it. The only thing they actually got was a postponement of annexation of the West Bank. And frankly, that wasn't going to happen anyways because the Americans didn't support it. I venture to say that even this new agreement, that was being negotiated and that's now off the table because of the conflict, the ongoing conflict, I venture to say that I don't think the Palestinians were going to get very much out of that one either. Now, that's hard to know because the actual details of the agreement were not finally negotiated and are not known. But given the Netanyahu government and coalition, that government never would have gone along with furthering a Palestinian state. At least two of its coalition members are actually in favor of annexation of the West Bank. And so the Netanyahu government would have fallen if Bibi had agreed to any great concessions to the Palestinians.
Understood.
Given the number of resistance groups currently present in the Middle East, what do you think country leaders, both in the Arab world and the West, can do in preventing tension from further escalating?
I think what really has to happen, for example, in the Israel-Palestine conflict, is to, once the trauma and the pain of this current conflict begins to subside a bit, and it will take time on both sides, once it does begin to subside, I think we have to follow what Joe Biden and Tony Blinken and Melanie Joly and others are prescribing, which is to create a political horizon in which the Israelis and the Palestinians see a way forward to a two-state solution. Because, frankly, the continued occupation of the West Bank and the continued isolation of Gaza simply can't go on for another 50 years. It's already been 56 years since the 1967 war when the occupation began. And although it seems difficult, and it is difficult, there are parameters, final status issues that have been discussed at length in the past. The bottom line is that other than emotion and distrust and disrespect, the other factors really haven't changed since Bill Clinton worked with Arafat and with Yitzhak Rabin. So what really has to happen is you've got to get at the root causes of these current conflicts. And by getting at the root conflicts and beginning to deal with them, you diffuse and reduce the power of these terrorist groups. You're not going to be able to, you can attack and kill and defeat some Hamas leaders and both military and political, but you're not going to defeat the ideology. The way to defeat an ideology that says Israel and the Jews have to be ridden from the Middle East is to offer the Palestinians an alternative, a real alternative, which is their state eventually. They're going to have to get their act together. Israel is going to have to get its act together. They're going to have to find leaders who are prepared to compromise and who can show real leadership and explain to their respective populations that this is a better route than violence and occupation. And that's what has to happen. You've got to address root causes, not just simply think that violence is somehow going to end the problem. These terrorist groups, these militant groups, tend to be able to survive a long time. It's the support for them that has to be gotten at.
Understood. Well, for one, I really wanted to thank you today on behalf of Beyond the Headlines, John, for joining us today. Your insight was incredibly valuable.
Well, thanks very much for having me, and maybe we'll be able to do this again another time.
Once again, that was Mr. John Allen, who joined us for a discussion on insurrectionism and political dissent in the Middle East. Thank you for tuning in for Beyond the Headlines. Remember, you can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us on Twitter at beyond_headlines, checking out our website, www.beyondtheheadlines.net, or by following us on Instagram at Beyond the Headlines. Thank you for joining us.
Our second guest today is Alejandro Paz. Professor Paz is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Toronto Scarborough, and he has written about the politics of migration, language, and citizenship in Israel and Palestine, as well as settlement in occupied East Jerusalem. His book, Latinos in Israel, Language and Expected Citizenship, was published in 2018. His current research is about Israeli English online journalism and its impact on North Atlantic public opinion. So welcome, Alejandro. Such a pleasure to
have
you.
Thank you so much, Vicky. I'm glad to be here.
All right. So let's just dive right into the questions. So to understand the current Israel-Hamas conflict, I think it's imperative to trace back the history from 30 years ago in 1993 when the Oslo Accord was signed. The signing of the Oslo Accord marked a significant milestone as the first direct peace agreement between the officials' representatives of Israel and Palestine. There's this famous handshake picture, and I'm sure you've seen it. It's all over the internet between the Israeli Prime Minister Isaac Rabin and the chairman of PLO, Yasser Arafat, with Bill Clinton standing in the middle as the intermediating party. And the resulting agreement granted limited self-governance to Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip through the establishment of the Palestinian Authority, or the PA. So many view this event as a pivotal moment for the region, with both parties committing to resolve their longstanding conflict. Reflecting on the past 30 years, I want to ask you, do you believe the Oslo Accord was a successful peace agreement at its inception?
So thank you for the question. The short answer is no. I don't think it was a successful peace agreement. There are many, many reasons for that. But before I talk about the reasons, there are many historians, Palestine, Israel, of the region, who would actually date that the history we need to understand goes back to the British Mandate period, that is the period of British rule in Palestine between 1917 and 1948. But I'm gonna bracket that and speak directly to the problems right from its inception of the Oslo Accords. So the Oslo process, many people don't know or don't remember. I like to talk about it as the Oslo process rather than, you know, one accord or another accord, and without, you know, getting into the weeds of the details. But the Oslo process is a series of agreements that were signed between the Israeli government, which had a military rule over what became known post 1967 as the occupied Palestinian territories, meaning the West Bank, the Gaza Strip especially. But when I say the West Bank, I also want to be clear that we're talking about East Jerusalem. So that's a point where the Israeli government, all of them, have never really recognized that East Jerusalem is anything but, since 1967, is anything but Israeli territory. It was annexed quite soon after 1967. The problems with the Oslo Accord stemmed from the fact that, you know, a kind of forgotten history, that after the First Intifada, or at the end of the First Intifada, there was an attempt to have a negotiation, which was sponsored in part by the U.S. and other Western governments, between the leadership from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and mediated through with the Americans, with the Israelis as well. It started with the Madrid Conference, 1991, and then there was a move for more negotiations directly in Washington. And there was a lot of plans that had already been produced by this leadership in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which wasn't entirely controlled by the PLO. And so many historians see that the PLO leadership, especially Yasser Arafat, at that time was kind of excluded from the negotiations. So there was already a process of negotiations at Madrid and then later in Washington, based on a lot of planning that had been done by the leadership in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And to a certain extent, the Oslo process began by circumventing those negotiations. And that leadership, you know, in the Madrid and Washington negotiations was pushing for what could have been a viable two-state solution. You know, of course, who knows what would have happened, but they had a much broader understanding of what a two-state solution needed to be, and they were unwilling to compromise and have concessions for anything less than a state. The Oslo process was based on the idea, the Prime Minister in 1992, Yitzhak Rabin, who is remembered as kind of a hero of the Oslo process, said it clearly, on the idea of not establishing a Palestinian state. As he put it, state minus, Medina minus, to his negotiating team. This has been discussed by historians like Ilan Pape, Rashid Khalidi, who are, you know, some of the most prominent historians today of Palestine, Israel, and the ongoing colonial occupation. So right from the signing of the first Oslo Accord in 1993, there was already members of that leadership, like Haider Abdel Shafi, who led the, I believe, the PLO delegation in Madrid and later in Washington, who criticized it immediately because of all the concessions that had been made. Now, it's important to remember that the idea of a state was still pretty much anathema to the Israeli leadership. That is, a Palestinian state was anathema to the Israeli leadership in the early 1990s. Instead, what they were shooting for was something that came up during the Camp David agreements with Egypt in the late 1970s, of an autonomy. And that's more or less what the Israelis agreed to and which the Palestinian Authority sort of became. Of course, not everything was negotiated in advance, but the way that slowly over time, the West Bank, Gaza Strip is a different situation, East Jerusalem as part of the West Bank have been cut up by more and more settlements, by more and more checkpoints, by other aspects of Israeli occupation, which deny what is usually called territorial contiguity to the Palestinians. That was kind of the conception that the Israeli leadership, you know, both military and political, was thinking of when they signed the Oslo Accords. It could have gone in other directions. You know, there could have been pushback here or there, but, you know, this concept of autonomy is more or less where we ended up.
Thank you. That was a very long, thorough answer.
Sorry.
That was a very good history lesson. And I think I learned from your talk about the history. And I guess it's safe to say that there was a lot of uncertainty with the Oslo Accord at the signing, and over the years, there is even a more declining trend with the Oslo Accord. And many would argue that it has significantly deteriorated following the death of the Israel's past prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin. So can you talk to us a little bit more about this downfall?
Yeah, so I already started to get into it a little bit, but the assassination of Rabin certainly didn't help the Oslo process. But as I've kind of suggested, the concept of autonomy versus a full independent state was where Rabin started. He directed his negotiating team, this team which circumvented the Madrid process and went through a Norwegian kind of think tank to negotiate a separate, like negotiate on a parallel path, which eventually ended the Washington negotiations, right? So this was his idea kind of from the get-go. Who knows if, you know, under his leadership, something would have changed. I doubt it. But the Oslo process already saw, probably most importantly, that there was no end to the expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, and at the time in the Gaza Strip to a lesser extent, but East Jerusalem especially. Well, I mean, we continue to see the expansion of East Jerusalem settlements now being protested around the world, like with Sheikh Jarrah a couple of years ago. That all continued even under Rabin, but especially with the election of the Likud government of Netanyahu in 1996, that received even more impetus. So let me give you a couple of statistics. If the population of the West Bank, and this excludes East Jerusalem, of Jewish Israeli settlers was about 110,000 in 1993 at the signing of the first of the Oslo Accords. 10 years later, it had more than doubled. And that's just like one aspect of the way that the Israeli military regime, which is called the civil administration over the occupied territories, has taken land and put more and more kind of Israeli infrastructure, so bypass roads, checkpoints, declarations of nature reserves, closed military zones. All of these are mechanisms for denying territory to Palestinian populations. In East Jerusalem, so that first statistic was based on statistics from the Foundation for Middle East Peace. In East Jerusalem, the population, the Jewish Israeli settler population was already about 155,000 in 1996, and then has gone up steadily, though maybe not as dramatically as in the rest of the West Bank since then. You have over 120 settlements and settlement outposts that have been established since 1993, as well as the expansion of the settlements that were established between 1967 and 1993. And it's important to remember that all the West Bank settlements, including those in occupied East Jerusalem, are considered illegal under international law.
Thank you for the statistics. I think sometimes numbers are more powerful than facts. And I think by giving me all the numbers, it really gives me a better understanding of what the condition is like over the past 30 years between the region. I want to kind of push a little bit further into the Oslo Accord and ask you, do you think that despite all these misunderstandings during the past 30 years and at the signing of the Oslo Accord, do you think this current war would have been prevented if each side is to do something different? Or do you think this escalation has already been foreshadowed 30 years ago?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say, I wouldn't be as so deterministic to say that we could predict from 1993 what would happen in 2023. Exactly. However, what we could say, and what, you know, the critics of the PLO's signing or Yasser Arafat's signing of the Oslo Accords already said, is that this was not a political solution. Everybody who I talked to, people, experts, Israeli, Palestinian colleagues, experts, have been saying since 2021 that things are really bad in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, in East Jerusalem, that some kind of explosion is just around the corner. Nobody who looks at these issues closely was surprised that something like what happened on October 7th happened. As everybody says, without a political solution, you will not get to a place where Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace and security for both of them with flourishing lives. As long as the Israeli colonial regime is based on the supremacy of the Jewish Israeli population over the Palestinian population. And I'm not just talking about Gaza Strip, West Bank, East Jerusalem. I'm also talking about what, you know, Israel as recognized by the UN after the 1949 armistice, right? Even within that part of the country, Palestinian citizens do not have equal rights. There's many ways that they are contained to overpopulated, densely populated towns and cities with lesser infrastructure, lesser opportunity for flourishing, and so on and so forth. Because of this system, many international human rights organizations, including Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, have stated that the state of Israel has committed the crimes of apartheid and persecution. So without a political solution, and the Oslo Accords were not a political solution, and they did not lead to a political solution, the problems are going to keep coming up until Israeli leaders can say and take into consideration Palestinian aspirations for recognizing their rights. This is going to keep being a problem.
Do you think there has been any negotiation efforts between the two states before the current war? Or do you think because there's the power imbalance, attempts to fortify or to renegotiate the region would be kind of pointless?
So, yeah. So I would say between the representatives of the peoples rather than the states.
My apologies.
Yeah, no worries. Because even sometimes Israeli leaders consider Gaza to be a state that is ruled by Hamas, but there's a complete siege since 2007. And really, people say that 2007, the blockade or the systems for limiting mobility of Palestinians, of commodities, go, as some Israeli journalists have pointed out, were intensifying since the early 1990s. So at the same time that you have this negotiation between, you know, Israeli leadership and the PLO that ended up with with the Oslo Accords, you have intensification of the military securitization of separation between Israeli and Palestinian populations. But let me get to your question. So the negotiations have always maintained that premise of that the Israeli kind of colonial regime stays in place, and that Palestinians, in order to negotiate, must first recognize the legitimacy of that colonial regime. And this is, by the way, something that Palestinian historian Rashid Khalidi pointed out. He's not the first, but pointed out very clearly in his recent book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. Goes back to that British colonial state over Palestine that I mentioned earlier. This requirement of the Palestinian leaders to first recognize the premise that was used to dispossess Palestinians. So the negotiations, basically since the mid-2000s, have reached a stasis, and especially under Netanyahu. Even when American presidents like Obama sent Joe Biden in 2010, in a famous example, he arrived to try to once again kickstart the negotiations. And on the day of his arrival, I forget how many exactly, hundreds or thousands of new units were announced for East Jerusalem. So the major symbol of Israeli intransigence, the expansion of settlements in what Palestinians would consider to be their territory in a two-state solution, that was kind of announced as Joe Biden arrives. And John Kerry ran into similar kinds of issues. So what ended up happening is, especially under Netanyahu, is the idea that the Israeli leadership only needed to manage, quote-unquote, manage the conflict. There was no need to return to negotiations. There's a long, complicated history about how that took place. It happened also in part when an earlier prime minister, Ehud Barak, said that there was no partner for peace, and that kind of became this phrase that kept getting repeated. But as many, many people have pointed out since October 7th, what this meant under Netanyahu is this kind of unstable dynamic where the Israeli leadership would prop up Hamas as governing authority in the Gaza Strip in order to weaken the Palestinian authority. The current finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, said on TV when he wasn't finance minister, this is going back, I think it's 2015, but he said it when he was an MK, Hamas is an asset. Neches is the word he used in Hebrew. Neches, asset. Because the Palestinian Authority is what you don't want to strengthen, right? So to undermine the Palestinian Authority, Hamas is an asset. And according to Israeli journalism, Netanyahu said similar things in 2018 or 2019. And it's very clear from his actions that that's how he saw himself managing the conflict. This kind of unstable dynamic with Hamas to maintain Hamas's rule so that the Palestinian Authority would be ever more undermined. And the reason that both Smotrich and Netanyahu and others were in favor of this was to undermine the possibility of any more territorial concessions under the rubric, the so-called rubric of two-state solution. But again, I want to remind you of what I said earlier, that that was for the Israelis. Two-state solution never meant a full Palestinian state in control of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza.
I see that you brought up Hamas a couple of times when talking about the current conflict. So I wanted to ask you, on the topic of Hamas, do you think the breakdown of the Oslo Accord gave rise to Hamas in Palestine?
So in here, I have to say that I'm relying on a book by Tariq Bakoni and others. Hamas's significance in the story, its rise to political prominence, does, I think, depend on this shift that happened when the PLO, which had managed to become Fatah-led PLO, the Yasser Arafat-led PLO, which had managed to become, in the eyes of most Palestinians, I would say, and for many international bodies, kind of a legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. And then through the Oslo Accords, as many, many analysts have put it, the PLO became the Palestinian Authority, and its chief job from the perspective of the Israeli government was to do the work of the Israeli military regime in maintaining Israeli security, right? In the areas where it, like what it later became called Area A's, which is, I know, is the densest, the areas where you had the densest Palestinian population centers like Ramallah, Nablus, and Jenin, and other places. And so instead of, under the Oslo process, a sense of by Palestinians of attaining freedom in their own state, what they ended up was with their own police forces policing them instead of the Israelis. So that created an enormous amount of resentment, as well as everything else I mentioned earlier, like the impositions of more and more checkpoints, more and more security boundaries, bypass roads, the increase of settlements, all of that together. Plus, there was this process where, you know, after 1967, the Palestinian economy in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, was forcibly made to depend on the Israeli commodity and labor markets. So suddenly, with all of this new checkpoints and boundary maintenance, like the new kinds of security put into place, increasing settlements, Palestinians were having more and more trouble making a living. So all of that resentment was not only against the Israeli authorities, and there's, remember, this is a military regime. Palestinians don't have the right to vote for the government, which is basically ruling them, right? That's, many people talk about the one state condition, meaning the Israeli government is ultimately the government that's ruling them, but they don't have the vote if they're not citizens. All of that, I think, laid the conditions for that resentment to turn to other kinds of messages. Now, Hamas started much earlier with, you know, charitable organizations, healthcare, schooling, and so on. And only in 1987, in response to how the Israeli military decided to put down what's called the First Intifada, did they turn to more militarized actions. They started to arm themselves and carried out a series of attacks, especially in the 1990s, in Israeli populations. It must be said that they targeted civilians at that time. So they kind of became a different option for understanding the struggle against, at the time in the 1990s, 25 years of living under military occupation without rights. That's how, you know, I think Hamas managed to leverage that resentment into becoming a different option for thinking about the politics of Israel's quite brutal military occupation.
Thank you. I think you kind of touched upon my next question. So for the interest of time, I'm just going to skip over to my last question, which is more broad. So looking forward, do you think a reconciliation could be reached one day between Palestine or Israel? And if so, do you think the involvement of the Western countries, for example, the U.S., is helping in this process?
That's a couple of different questions. Let me start with the last part about the U.S. So since the 50s, but especially since the 1960s and 70s, the U.S. has basically seen the Israeli state as an ally that can help with their own foreign or imperial interests, depending on which vocabulary you prefer. So the U.S. so far hasn't been able to push the Israeli leadership at any point in time into making the kinds of concessions that could lead to a political solution. And more or less, we could say the same thing about Canada, about Great Britain or the United Kingdom, France, Germany, just to pick the largest kind of Western countries. Is there a way to reconciliation? I mentioned it before. The Palestinian people have a legitimate right to equal rights, to freedom, to security, just like the Israelis. As long as the only state that exists, the Israeli state, is premised on the supremacy of the Jewish people living under its rule, there's not going to be a reconciliation. Now, I just want to be really clear. I'm not making any kind of programmatic statement here. Right? How exactly you get there is not clear to me, especially right now. You know, there's things that I think could happen, But we require that process of the kind of systemic racism that is built in into the institutions of the Israeli state to be, as the term we've come to accept, is decolonized, right? Just as the way we in Canada, in the US, in other countries, we challenge the systemic racism that has grown out of the way the Canadian state was violently founded and the US state was violently founded. So the Israeli state requires that kind of criticism and the kinds of civil rights movements that we've seen in other countries in ways that will lead to a full-scale decolonization of the state. A lot of people react to that kind of statement with enormous fear. But we need to see it differently. We need to see it as really the only way where we can get a reconciliation. And again, I'm not sure how that would look in the future, like in terms of how the polity would look, one state, two states, some kind of confederation. There's a lot of ideas floating around. I'll be very frank and say, you know, I see the one state solution when it becomes possible as the most just. And that includes the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Again, these things scare a lot of people, especially who see themselves as somehow made safe by the state of Israel. But there's no safety if millions of people do not have their rights, cannot feel free, are not treated as equal. We see that in Canada, we see that in the US, we saw that in South Africa. And that's why there's these struggles for equal rights. I believe we can get there. I'm not sure exactly how right now. These are really sad and terrible times, but I don't think we have an option and we have to get there.
I appreciate your hopeful spirit. And I think that's a very powerful point to end our conversation on. So once again, it was Professor Alejandro Paz who joined us for a discussion on the Oslo Accord and the road to reconciliation between Israel and Palestine. Thank you for tuning in for Beyond the Headlines.
You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. We were joined today by John Allen and Alejandro Paz. Many thanks to them for coming onto the show and discussing histories of the Palestine-Israel conflict and the rise of insurrection group in the Middle East. Today's show was produced by myself, Vicky Lee, alongside my co-producer, Julia Brahi. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you're listening. The views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, or the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any part of the show, be sure to check out podcasts of all of our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show and want to stay up to date with policy issues in Canada and around the world, follow us on Twitter at Beyond Headlines. That's at BYOND_headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook or Instagram. Be sure to stay tuned next week as we continue to take public policy discussions out of the hallways and onto the airwaves. Bye-bye now!